Welcome, everybody, to the June edition of In the Now. Got JP, BR.
¿Qué pasa?
Demetrius.
Hola.
BR.
Hola.
Hola. All right. So, how you guys been up doing?
Pretty good.
Pretty good.
Swell, actually.
Cool. Rad.
All right. Well, we got a lot of good things to talk about. JP is only going to be able to be with us for a little bit of time.
Oh, no.
I'm going to go into the story briefly, and then I'll give you some updates after this. Okay. Well, I know last month we were talking about quantum-based computing, and there's been a new news article that was put out by the news that was about a new way of doing computing, which is basically light-based computers that run on quantum speeds. The benefit of a light-based computer is that you don't have to have all of the particles of an atom work together in such a complex way. It's a little bit more feasible, and it's a little bit easier to do, and it's a little bit easier to implement, and it's overall less trouble. Let's see. New light-based computer runs at quantum speeds. A simple computer that marries the mind-boggling computer power of quantum mechanics with the ease of manipulating light that has been built by researchers at the University of Rochester. The device prones that the specific quirk of atoms, which lets scientists conduct huge computations almost instantly, can be perfectly mimicked by light, which is much more practical to control than individual atoms. The result could be a computer that performs some task at a billion times faster than today's supercomputers. Using relatively simple technology that's well already understood, the research behind the device that was revealed at the Lasers and Electro-Optics Quantum Electronics and Laser Science Conference in Baltimore. That's a really long name. I wouldn't want to make the banners for that. The device mimics quantum interference, correct, an important property that makes quantum computers exponentially faster and tasks such as breaking encryption codes or searching huge databases. Instead of interference, conventional computers use particles called electrons to perform tasks sequentially. Like a librarian looking for a book by inspecting the entire library one volume at a time, interference essentially allows you to make clones of the librarian, one librarian for every book, and set them all loose at once. The new device proves that that using light interference is just as effective as quantum interference in retrieving items from the database. And I'll go into a little bit of detail more how it works. The maker of it is Professor Ian Wamsley. His device uses a piece of transparent tellurium dioxide called an acousto-optic modulator. This acts as a database for storing the information in the form of acoustic waves. The transducer vibrates against one side of the modulator, sending waves through it, much like a stereo speaker would send sound waves through the air. The waves simply compress some parts of the modulator and slightly expand others, creating a pattern in which the database information resides. To search the database, Wamsley directs a beam of light towards the modulator. The light is first split into two, with one part traveling through a prism so that a rainbow of different frequencies of light shines on the modulator. Each frequency shines through a different compressed or expanded part of the tellurium dioxide, which bends the frequency of light the way a straw appears bent when sticking out of a glass of water. The rainbow of frequencies is then recombined into a single beam. By mixing the new beam into the original beam, then entering the device, a single frequency will emerge as having been altered by its trip through the database. So in the case of Wamsley's device, 50 different frequencies of light shine through the modulator, and if the 20th frequency is the altered one, then Wamsley knows that the bit of information that's contained in the location of the 20th piece of the database is the answer. A conventional computer would have to check 20 times to find the location. If the database in question were the Manhattan phone book, the search for a single phone number would take a conventional computer 7 million searches instead of a light-based computer, which would just pinpoint it in just one search. Sounds pretty interesting.
Yeah, well, my personal policy has always been the more librarians, the better. But seriously, I don't know, it sounds pretty cool. I was thinking about that before. Like, basically, you're just sending out a bunch of stuff, and then whatever matches you see, how it bends the light, I think I get the basic concept of it. I just had to be the guy who has to repair it if it gets broken.
Yeah, I think there's no repair. I think you just have to replace the whole unit, so.
Yeah, I have a question here. The word quantum really means, like, measure, right? And it's usually a quantum is how much energy it takes to kick an electron up one energy state.
Mm-hmm. Next P shell or whatever?
Yeah, or S shell or sub shell. So I'm really kind of annoyed at, like, this complete overuse of the word essentially measure in describing all this, you know, tech.
I do know that quantum... when an electron goes up in the valence shell or whatever it is, it gives off light.
Yeah.
And that light is the measure of how much energy it took to get to it.
Well, normally it actually absorbs the light or whatever the energy it is to take that. It gives off light when it drops down one.
Yeah, I think
that's really the quantum.
Yeah.
So wouldn't that be appropriate then, since we're talking about light-based computing?
I think it would be.
Okay.
But I'm sure you can be sick of it either way.
Yeah, because it's this really abstract one little thing that's called a quantum that has been abstracted and butchered and proliferated
into... It'll be a new buzzword.
Yeah, I know. Think about, technology, that's the source of all crappy, annoying buzzwords. Think about the word solutions. I mean, how many billions of times have you heard that?
Yeah, I'm pretty sick of that.
Nauseous.
Well, I've already gotten sick from all these academic lectures where they talk, well, this is a quantum leap, and I'm like, and they want to make it sound really big, and I'm like, that's one of the smallest units of measure there are. Wow.
It is a good TV show.
That is funny, though. Why wouldn't they do that quantum leap? Like a quantum leap of it? That's a tiny thing.
That is true.
I guess, whatever, I don't know.
Okay. Well, if we were engineers, I'm sure we could spend next hour or so talking about it. But since we're not, let's move on to the next story.
Yeah, I just had to pitch about that.
Well, one of the stories that I've been reading about lately is turning PlayStation 2s and possibly the Xbox when it comes out into cheap PCs. I mean, think about it. For $300, you get a DVD player, you get a video game system, and you get a PC with the right software. What they're offering for the PlayStation is, they talked about a 20 gigabyte hard drive, a 40 gigabyte hard drive possibly, for those two different options, and a keyboard and a mouse, and then you can plug in the like a 10/100 NIC card into your one of the ports on the PlayStation 2, and then essentially turning into a functional PC. And I was reading a little bit, because it's been pretty vague, because it's kind of a new story been going around, but it's not quite complete as to what they're going to do as far as the final solution. But they've been thinking about putting Linux on PlayStation 2s, which would be pretty darn neat. So, I mean, if you really think about it, the PlayStation 2 has a lot of things to offer as far as just playing video games. I mean, you have all that hardware and all that system just for video games. I think there'd be a lot more that you could use to it. So I think it's pretty cool they'd be turning into a PC.
Yeah, well, when I read about that, I thought it was a surprisingly good deal. You have access to all that for that cheap price, and the reason that you get such a good deal out of it is because Sony loses money on every PlayStation they sell. They try to make it up in licensing fees. Like when, say, Capcom makes a game for the PS2, they get a certain bit of money for every game that's sold, so that's where they make it up. So in the difference, the consumer really gets the profit, because you're getting a machine that processes more than really you're paying for. And if you switch it over then and use it, like, if I'm not mistaken, I think there was a Linux kit already available in Japan for the PS2, and it was a really cheap price, so yeah, that'd be a really good deal. But
yeah, the only downfall is that they weren't going to bring it to, well, so far, they're not going to bring it to America or Europe, so. But
yeah. All right, well, that's it for me. I must be off in my quest to slaughter millions of polar bears, but until next month, I will catch you guys later.
All right, I'll see you later, JP.
See you later in the Polar Bear Club.
The Polar Bear Club.
Can I get some polar bear pants out of that?
Polar bear pants. So, yeah, for everyone, JP's got to take off. He's got some prior engagements to take care of. But we must move on with the show. So, another thing that the PlayStation 2 was going to offer is they're going to partner up with AOL, and together they're going to bring, I don't really know if I would want this on my PlayStation. But they're going to partner up with AOL, and they're going to have offer chat, email, web browsing. AOL, I think, is trying to get their way around, because this ties into another bit of story that's been going around, is that with new Windows XP, they have something that's called their .NET services. And I know a couple things about the .NET service, so I'm not quite versed in everything it does. But from my understanding, is what it does is, let's just say you have a JPEG, and you double-click the JPEG, and it doesn't open because you don't have a program that will process the JPEG. What .NET services will do is bring up, like, a web browser, point you... Oh, I already turned his mic off, so we're okay. It'll point you to a Microsoft website that will show you a product that you can probably download for free, or you can pay for and purchase right there on the Internet. The only problem with the .NET services is that it only points to Microsoft vendors or Microsoft-supported parties. So if, let's just say, you know, if Dimitri makes a program, and it's this beautiful program like the GIMP for Linux, which is a free photo program, sort of image manipulation and creation, it won't point to that website because it's not a part of the Microsoft group of people that are supported. I think that's really a problem. They had an article about AOL, and they had a newsletter that was leaked. Actually, it was an email that was leaked, and they don't know if it's real or not, but it sounded pretty real. If I was AOL, I would have wrote this email. And it was from one of their higher-ups, and it basically discussed all the options of how AOL can stay in the game as far as offering Internet solutions. There we go with the solutions word. I just didn't know that. Offering Internet access to people, because let's just say you buy Windows XP and you want to get on the Internet, and let's just say it points all these Windows users to an MSN site or a Microsoft-supported site, then basically AOL is knocked out. Like AOL in the past, if anyone remembers, is that they've passed out tons of CDs, mailed tons of CDs to you for 500 hours, 1,000 hours, month free, to get you in. So that's how they got you on board. And that's the way the .NET services worked. And later on, there was another story talking about how AOL now will be offered pre-installed with Windows XP. So, I don't know. I'm really not too happy with AOL. I mean, it's actually, the service isn't so bad. You pay $20 for a full month, and it's not so bad. I think if you have a child, they've got a lot of their own personal web pages that they've made, their own keywords that they can go to for children or people who are looking for certain things. I think there's an added benefit to it. But overall, I mean, if you just want to get on the Internet, you don't need all the junk that AOL offers. Just an average Internet user. So, you guys have anything to say about that?
I don't like the idea that it's going to come pre-installed with AOL. You know, it seems like you could have a choice.
Yeah.
You know, we don't really have a choice with Microsoft products. To me, they don't even work very well. We don't really have much of a choice.
Yeah, when in doubt, reboot all the time. Yeah, it's pretty annoying.
My computer actually came pre-installed with Microsoft everything.
Yeah.
And I just turned it on, and oh, already installed. I didn't even have a choice.
Yeah, and you from that, most consumers aren't going to buy something else.
Right, like, you know, even though I hear great things about Linux, I haven't gone out and done it, have I?
Yeah, because it's too easy to have Microsoft.
Yeah, good point. With Linux, okay, for me it's easy because I've done it and I have the experience, but and this isn't to down Linux, I think what they're doing is great, but for the average consumer side, when you buy a computer, you've probably worked with Microsoft previously. You haven't worked with Linux previously. And let's just say you want to run through the Linux install. Okay, before it was almost a nightmare for most people. When I first did my Linux install in like 93, 94, it was a lot of work, and I had to read for about a month just to figure out how to get it installed. But yeah, for the Microsoft experience, you know, it's already there. You probably used it before, and you don't go off and buy another product because it's right there. And with the .NET services, basically now they're going to redirect your attention every time it seems that you're missing something to a Microsoft-supported product. Download it, pay for it right there. I mean, it's pretty crazy because they have a lot of things that get you sucked in. I mean, they have the Microsoft Passport. So what the Microsoft Passport is, all your name and information, you can use your Microsoft Passport, go to Microsoft sites, buy Microsoft products, it works for your Microsoft system. If it's not a Microsoft product, it won't be supported, blah, blah, blah. So in the end, they're slowly setting up guidelines and rules and features that are just going to keep grabbing you into these Microsoft products. And even if I thought that Microsoft had a really good product on everything and it was a really good computing system, the problem is I don't believe in the antics that they use to get these people to only use Microsoft products. And the problem else that it creates is that these smaller vendors are now being shut out of business. Basically, you know, they get to get on the Microsoft bandwagon. If they get on the Microsoft bandwagon, it's going to cost them money. If they want to use, like, certain Microsoft DLLs to help make their programs run faster, they get to pay for them. It's going to cost them money. And to me, I just... And then another problem is that they have the thing with Microsoft that they, you know, that they declared a monopoly and that they were going to split the companies. Well, nobody's been trying to split the company into companies, and nobody's been trying to do that whatsoever. That I've seen in the public eye, I haven't seen anything. And now my belief is now we have Bush in office, and we have somebody that backs these corporate companies a little bit more, and I don't think Microsoft's going anywhere. So my pitch right now is that stick with Linux, stick with a free operating system, even if it's Linux, Trinix, something else that somebody else creates, support these guys and try to get behind them. If you're, you know, if you're able to do that and if you're comfortable doing that, choose the alternative, take the extra step and use the other operating system and support those other pieces of software out there, like MP3.
Yeah, actually support diversity instead of the Republican standpoint of the macro institution.
Yeah, I mean, do it for your own good. Do it because you want to live in a society that actually supports the little guys as well. And by supporting the little guys, you have to help support those little guys. And I think the little guys out there that have, I mean, on the Linux counter, I know Linux has been a popular thing. And I don't talk about Linux because it's a popular thing now. It's more of, you know, getting more out there. I wasn't interested just because it's out there now. I was interested in it before. And I don't do it because, hey, you know, Linux is a cool thing. It's going to, you know, break up the problem with Microsoft and everything like that. That's not it. I have a lot of reasons why I really like the system, and there's some things that are buggy on it, but after a while, through support, it's going to be, and it can be, a good quality product that you can use, and it's been beneficial to many people. It's been beneficial to other countries with poor economies that can't afford a Microsoft. Is that where actually, solution can be used a lot, but it kind of gets annoying. But the Microsoft solution, if you set up their company on Microsoft, Linux is a cheaper way to go. And just by cheaper, it doesn't mean that the machine works in any less quality. I think it works by far much better.
And it is an open source system, correct?
Correct, yeah.
And so that would also nurture innovation and push what is in this, you know, the society of technology or the whole community of what computers are to further grow and expand and also consolidate at the same time into a more efficient, you know, user-friendly system.
Yeah, and for those of you who don't know what open source is when you create a program and you write it using code, because that's how programs are created, typically when you compile a program, the code is now unreadable, and it's only readable by the machine. So the human being won't be able to take that code, copy it, and do his own compiler, or I mean his own program editor, and go through and write additions, change things, fix bugs, and then compile it again. And, I mean, he can even use it for his own use. So it's, you know, let's just say you have some data that you want to protect. Well, I would rather protect it with an open source project, because if I really want to take the extra effort, I could check the program to see if there's any backdoors in it. I can check to see if there's any glitches in it, if I'm that experienced and that knowledgeable, and I can go through and fix that. So I can trust what I'm using because I know what it is. I've taken it apart. I've looked at it. And with Microsoft, they don't let you take it apart. They don't let you look at it. And it's not Microsoft. There's other people out there with their products. There's some non-open source software on the Linux box. Not too much. Most of it's open source, but you know, they don't let you take it apart. And that's due majorly to for financial gain, and you don't want they don't want people copying their product, and so there's a lot of problems with that. And actually, here's one of the stories I was going to discuss is that actually I'll just read it straight out. The summary is what it is that the IIS server, which is Microsoft's internet server, has a backdoor password in it. A backdoor account where you insert a password and then you can get in. And basically, Microsoft said that they didn't know about it, and they can't cover everything. Let's just say I'm a Microsoft employee. I could probably sneak in a bit of code and they wouldn't see it. So that's what happened. Well, with the open source, it would have been spotted. And if it wouldn't have been spotted, you couldn't blame Microsoft. You couldn't blame anybody because it was there. You know, you blame the guy who did it. So to me, I would rather, if I was a company and I put out the software and it's open source, we'll say, hey, you know, we weren't trying to cover up anything. See, it's open source, blah, blah, blah. Somebody snuck it in. It's not our fault. I could forgive the guy better because I would probably trust him a little bit more because he showed me his code in the first place. So, okay. Here's a rather alarming article from Yahoo, which claims that Microsoft has a backdoor password into IIS web servers running FrontPage 98 server extensions. Here's another brilliant example of how closed-source development models are a threat to security and privacy on the Internet. The article says that Microsoft plans to alert customers as soon as possible with email bulletin advisory published on its corporate website. Okay, I'm going to know to go to its corporate website and look at this bulletin. This is really just too perfect. Actually, it's too perfect. Guess this similarity, this particular possibility for built-in backdoors is old news. So, there you go. That's one of the things we support on this show is, and speaking about in the now, is that in the now we're using this technology. In the now, we've got this in our homes. In the now, we know that it's a problem, and we know that there's other solutions, and we're just another person out there trying to support and find the solution. Because right now you're feeling comfortable with your Microsoft box, and you're feeling really happy everything's pre-installed for you. And you're feeling really happy that the .NET services will point you everywhere you need to go to get the product so you can start doing your stuff. And you're going to feel real happy. But meanwhile, the guys who aren't feeling really happy are the guys who are starting up the software companies and they're trying to put out software and they can't afford it on a Microsoft box. Because personally, if I was a software company with my morals put aside, I would probably want to put it on Microsoft because it's going to make me money because a lot of people have it. Well, those guys that have that thinking, they're going to have some problems and they're going to have to put out some dollars, and if they can't, they're going to be whacked out of the game, which is bad for consumers in the end. And it's just something that I personally don't support, and I don't think anybody here really supports. I think it's open, honest. I think it makes sense. I think people should open their minds up and think a little bit deeper. It's not just this kind of thinking for computers. It's for any product in your life. It's for health service, it's for dental service, it's for paying for school, college, it's for everything, paying your taxes. People need to balance out their power and let room for other people come in. So
I think you just opened up a whole can of worms when you started talking about, you know, because this kind of mentality goes on in the medical community and the university, in the universities. Just like with, let's get back to the medical, what I was really thinking about, is like what we consider alternative therapies now in, are actually, most of them are traditional, is they've been around for like thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
And because our, you know, our traditional medicine or, you know, empirical medicine, which lives up to scientific terms, can't explain why they work, or even if they do work.
They just trust it.
No, they say that they don't work.
Oh.
You know, like acupuncture, you know, homeopathic medicine, spectrochrome, one of my favorites right now. But yet, these things have been around for so long. Why? Because they do work. We've seen them work. You're the people who use them see them work. Now, what science does is it observes something and it goes, what causes that? Why does that happen? And then sets up an experiment, or, you know, tries to cut out all the variables for it, and try to find the direct cause. Well, when it can't do that, or, you know, because the system is too large and too complex, they're just throwing it out. Instead of looking at the human body as a complete interactive system. And so how can you really, you know, test the empirical, you know, test the scientific validity of, you know, the therapeutic practices of shining light on certain areas of your body and how that affects the system, you know, physically is incredibly difficult. But yet, I have personal research that of many, many pages that says that it does affect something.
Yeah, I've read that too. It's what I noticed, like normal science, like you go to the doctor and you say you got a problem, they just give you some drug. You know, it's really a drug to just sort of treat it but not cure the problem. It's like...
more like a masking.
Yeah, it's kind of like you drink a bunch of alcohol to get rid of your pain kind of thing. You're not really getting rid of the problem. You're just sort of dulling it your mind so it doesn't bother you so much kind of thing.
Yeah, you're no longer really witnessing the effect.
Yeah, that's pretty much what AIDS patients are. That's about the only treatment they have for them right now.
That's pretty much like it for anybody when it comes to traditional science. You know, some these drugs to do stuff. They don't really know what they're doing. And I can't blame them. Because how can you, like you say, how can you test these things and say, well, light, you know, shine light on your legs and that's supposed to help you out in some way?
Yeah, you will no longer have arthritis of your knees if you spend this amount of time in the sunlight at this angle in this humidity. Except these people do have these therapies that are that exact.
And I don't know, I can expect something like that to be true because we're natural, you know, we need light, we need the sunlight, everything needs sunlight, but you just can't have too much. So
Or not enough.
Yeah, you have to have a certain amount, you know, and I've heard 10 minutes a day, go out for 10 minutes a day, you'll be as healthy as possible, so.
Yeah, but that's such, you know, that depends on, like, what longitude you live at,
yeah.
You know, what your age is, you know, how fair skinned you are.
Yeah, so you really can't. You can't say.
Yeah, there's almost an infinite amount of variables in that.
Cool. Yeah. All right. Just one other thing that, get back to what I was talking about earlier, just one thing I want to add to wrap up my beef, is that the ACCC, and these are people over in Australia, says major Hollywood studios have collaborated with manufacturers of digital video disc players to prevent discs manufactured in U.S., Europe, or Asia from working in Australian machines, which is basically the DMCA and the DVD zones. The ACCC Commissioner Ross Jones said in the recent speech that zoning system prevents smaller film companies from distributing their movies around the world, which goes along with what I'm saying. If you're coming from Australia and you have to put an Australia region code on the DVD, for anybody else who would like to play it, they said here that typically you have to pay $20 more for a one that's able to be displayed and played in the other regions. So that's just another hint of people shutting out the little guys. Okay. Another story, quick story on fiber wiretapping. In the mid-1990s, the NSA installed one such tap, says former intelligence officials familiar with the covert project. Using a special spy submarine, they say agent personnel descended hundreds of feet into one of the oceans and sliced into a fiber optic cable. The mixed results of the experiment, particularly the agent's inability to make sense of the vast flood of data unleashed by the tap, show that America's preeminent spy service has huge challenges to overcome if it hopes to keep the from going deaf in the digital age. Veterans of the undersea fiber optic cable business say an undersea tap would strain the limits of technology, and cable operators aren't happy with the idea that NSA may have pulled one off. We don't believe this is possible, but assuming it was, there's no way we want someone trying to get into our cables, says Frank Deniston, chief technical officer for London-based Flag Telecom Holdings, one of the half dozen or so companies that dominate the industry. So, what do you guys think about that?
I don't even know it's possible to tap into like that. You know, you can't interfere with light so much, can you?
Well, from my understanding of DSL technology, basically when a light's sent through, it's sent through a system, and then the light and the power begin to run out, and it basically goes through like a repeater system where it'll shoot the light back out at a new burst. So it'll hit the repeater and then shoot back out and then keep going through and keep going through. And what they could have done is take the wire, splice it, but the problem with splicing it is that the other people would know, because the data would be lost and it would take some time. And I read a little bit more into the article, and it would take some time to do it, and they can't do it that fast. Some NSA agents, one of them said that it is possible, but the cable people say it's not possible. Okay, so what would happen is that it's spliced. It's now split, just like you'd split one cable into two cables for two televisions in your house. Okay. And then they could continue to have that repeater keep the power just as strong for the what its original use was for, and then keep it as strong for NSA's use. But to me, I have no idea how they would take that data and be able to siphon through it, because that is so much data. And basically, data doesn't come through in a legible form anyways. Most people that see data, if you do like a TCP dump from a Linux shell, you'll get a bunch of garbage that comes through, and some of it makes sense and some of it doesn't. So that'd be...
Like one strand of fiber optics can carry like 7 or 14 phone conversations.
One strand? No, that's like... I think it's like...
Or it's like
400 phone conversations.
Yeah, so if you try to splice into one, just one alone, you're going to get a whole, you know, cluster thing of chaos.
Well, in the packets, they have to send something in a packet that says, you know, like at the header, where it's going to and where to break it up, so they could actually filter through and select only packets that go from to a certain person or to a certain computer.
IP address.
IP address. And, you know, that's how networking works. They send out a packet of information through the net, and little packets go out at a time with information from this computer to this computer, you know.
Okay, so they're just getting, you know, little, like these little packets.
Well, yeah.
But they're not getting like the full conversation. They're just getting these little bits.
Yeah.
And still, even if they were able to pick those out, what are the chances that all of the packets that are going to go through, you know, just like a simple phone conversation, are going to go through the same cable in a regular interval, so you could pick that up
and put it
together and make a full like dialogue.
You have to string them back together again because they're even numbered.
Well, one thing to add is that to step back is to think about why would they want to do that in the first place. Well, the answer is obvious, but that's just no good. I don't want my data tapped.
Did you see Pearl Harbor?
Yeah.
That movie? That part where they were tapping the lines outside of America so they could see if they had any spies from Japan or anything. You know, if you can listen to a person's phone conversation out that goes out of America, then, you know, you can catch spies.
Well, the main purpose for... if it was done or why it was done, is that in the Gulf War, we could use satellite technology and we listened to one of Saddam Hussein's phone conversations. Well, they've got satellite technology tapped as far as they're able to process that, radio, normal copper wires. But now since the world and mainly the United States is now running off the these main backbones of fiber optics, which would be a nice place to tap. You wouldn't want to tap like 50 individual places. You want to go just for the main pipe, and to tap that would be a great way to get in information, a great way to figure out what's going on. So that's, I can see why they're doing that, but to me, you got to ask yourself, why does your country want to do that in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, isn't there enough monitoring going on?
Too much Big Brother going on.
Yeah, too much Big Brother
going on. Well, I just found out that, well, one of my friends I was talking to yesterday actually got pulled over for whatever and was automatically searched. His car was searched.
Oh, no.
Then now it's, you know, you get pulled over for, you know, any violation, it's probable cause to search your vehicle.
Is this something that is, as far as you said, like a new law, or it's just...
Or it's a new interpretation upon the law.
Basically, interpreting that it doesn't exist?
Now that you have broken the law, now they have probable cause to say that you may be breaking other laws.
Well, from my understanding of what I've read, because I actually read a lot about this, and I fully stress my rights if I'm being pulled over. I don't make a big deal to the police officer saying that I know my rights, blah, 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 but I do let him know if I feel he's overstepping his bounds. I will let him know that I am knowledgeable of my rights. And from what my understanding is, let's just say that if you have marijuana in the car and he finds a pipe in on your dashboard and he takes the pipe, he says, well, I need to search the rest of your car. He only needs to search where he, and this is very broad, but where he thinks there might be more marijuana or paraphernalia. But he could search the whole car thinking that.
Yeah. Right, because he could, well, yeah, sure.
He could be in the tires,
pipe,
you know.
The pipe was on the dash, but he may be storing it inside the, you know, the...
glove box, the trunk, the
right, in the liners of the door panels, yeah. Things of that nature.
So,
yeah, why they have dog sniffers?
From what my understanding is, from what I've seen a lot of things with the law and how it coincides with its citizens, is that most things allow the government, with maybe a little bit of trouble or no trouble at all, to basically do whatever they please. And there's not very much stipulation that's written to combat that. And that's a problem in itself.
Well, I think we saw that with the OJ trial of really who has the power. It's the, it's the money.
Yeah.
If you have the money, you can pretty much get out of anything.
Either the guy who married OJ's wife is really, really quiet, and he's not like most people that go off and blab and usually get themselves busted, or it's OJ. I don't know. I think it was OJ.
Because our government, well, now also we're seeing with the McVeigh trial, or execution now, is the government screws up a lot. And we're just really starting to see the, just, you know, on the horizon of how bad it can be.
I think so. I mean, if you think about how much money we've been giving the government and how much money they said they have for this tax cut. And the tax cut, that's a show in itself. I might talk a little bit about that. But the tax cut shows, I mean, we have a lot of money on layaway and projected money that's sitting on the side. But there's a lot of people that, I think overall there's a lot of good things going on in America, and it's some of the finer points that need to be tuned, and I think that, I think we have time to tune those things. I mean, I know there's a lot of busy people doing a lot of things, but I think we have time to tune those things, and I think it's just a mindset. I think if people had a general mindset to work as a community and a civilization, because we are in a civilization, and we don't need people that are only thinking of themselves or their agenda, I think we'd be better off. And like I said, when it goes back to the money issue, is that we do have some projected money, and that could be used to make that happen.
Well, it's because we really do live in a republic, and we all, you know, even I find myself taking that viewpoint of we elect our officials to...
to work for us.
To work for us, but they're the ones, their view matters. And once they are elected, they really become our voice, because we are not active or as proactive as we once were. Because the whole thing of when they get in there, they pretty much have full realm of whatever they want to do, except with the, you know, in relation with their peers of other, you know, of other elected officials. But how often do I get active in public politics? Not very.
Most people don't either.
Right, and that's really where the power lies, because there are 270 million of us, mm-hmm. and only
50,000 are.
No, only about 500 to, no, there's probably several thousand actually elected officials in this country. Now, if both of those two different parties had different views and were vocal about it, who would win?
Well, since we don't speak so much, it'd probably be them.
Yeah, because right, we're
but,
considered
that's
the
why
herd.
I put in the little vocal thing in there.
Because we're considered the herd, you know. No one actually sees themselves as being equal with the elected officials. So they think, well, I don't really have any say. I don't have any purpose. You know, there's nothing I can do. So really, the people who are in politics in the government would win. Not because, you know, of any other reason, but because we think they're above us somehow.
Right, because we've put them there. We've given them our choice, our will.
Well, right now, our few choices to get our word out is, well, we can send them information to the offices, and then on our own, we can use protesting, radio, and television to get the words out. Problem with television is we maybe have one channel that nobody watches.
Yeah, it's public access.
Yeah. And with problem with radio is that it's mostly corporate.
It's expensive as hell.
It's relatively all corporate.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say it's 99% corporate. If you want to have pirate radio, you go to jail.
Yeah, but we own the airwaves.
That's the problem.
We own all the radio, all the TV stations.
And we let them lease it. But we don't get any money, and they take away our speech. And the thing with protesting is that most of the time when you protest, I mean, they got a bunch of guys out there with no weapons, and for some reason they've got, rubber bullets, and they've got those concussion grenades. I saw the problem that they had to happen down in Tucson, in Arizona, that they had, after their game, there was kind of a riot, and this one building got caught on fire. Now, what they did is that they brought out the police, which is nothing wrong with that. They brought out the riot gear, which is nothing wrong with that, because they don't know what's going to happen next. They controlled the crowd. Most people dispersed. And then there was a couple people laying around on the streets. Okay, what I don't understand is now that there's maybe 50 or fewer people on the streets, more people showed up. And that's okay if they show up because they want to take control of the area. But what they did is they started shooting rubber bullets at a couple people, not very many. There's been places where a lot of rubber bullets have been shot for no necessary reason. Concussion grenades were thrown. They inserted their control far beyond their means. And now, this is a mild situation. Nothing was really super bad happening. There was a couple people hurt, but point is that they didn't need to assert that much power. That much power when there was a crowd that was defenseless, about 50 or less, and they didn't. Those few people that I think it was maybe like 10 or few, with a couple minor injuries. Those 10 people didn't deserve those injuries. And to speak on a grander scale, there's been other protesting places where, well, this wasn't a protest. This was because of a riot. But this is basically they treat it as if it's a riot, and people have been protesting, and then they've been shot with rubber bullets. Or, nobody that I know has been killed, but that's one of our voices. And for some reason, they treat us as if we're a riot, as if we're causing problems. There is actually proper ways to assert your protests. You can actually say we're going to have a protest. They are supposed to provide you with an area for your protest. And as long as you're in that area for your protest, you're fine. If you don't go to certain, if you don't harass people, they're supposed to provide you with a means of protest. And if you stay nonviolent and non-harassing to others,
But if you do that within the Clinton administration, they put you at a protest spot about a half mile away.
Yeah, that's bad.
Yeah, where it's relatively pointless to even protest because you're no longer being associated to what you're protesting.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's kind of funny that, really, if you think about it, you know, cities are incorporated. They're actually a company. That's what they are. And it's really what the government is. And why isn't we just don't walk away? Why don't we say we don't want your business?
Why don't we do like a hostile takeover of stock? We buy all the bonds that the government gives out and say, we are taking it back.
There's nothing there. They created that demand. That's nothing.
We could pull a fight club.
That's so funny.
And we can use this radio show as, well, it's not radio, but we can use this show as a means of as pulling the fight club off.
That's funny, though, if you think about it. Really, money is just an artificial demand. They created it.
Yeah, it's essentially this. It's essentially stock now, yeah. Where it's not backed by really, well, it's, yeah, stock is actually backed by the company, but money is backed by nothing except for
whatever
our perceived value of it.
Yeah.
That's it.
Well, in saying that, I believe in that, but it actually has become a need, a major need.
What, money?
Yeah.
We're
not going to go back and start trading our baseball caps for, like, you know, gallons of milk.
But
I know what you mean.
Yeah, it's because it works because I perceive what a dollar is worth.
Yeah.
You perceive what a dollar is worth. And so, therefore, we can have an equal transaction. But it's because we all use the same, essentially, medium of value transfer. It's kind of nifty how it works.
It's more
just like the internet
system.
Because we all use the phone lines and transfer our value, our information, through different mediums. Well, through the same medium, but to different platforms. To the store, to the gas station, to the server, to the... Okay, I'm getting way off.
Yeah, we basically use these means that we've created as far as all these things do. So we're doing the same thing we did 50 years ago. We just have different means of doing it. But there should be more room to get our voice out. Much more room.
Yeah, which is kind of, you know... And that's what's really sad, is we should be able to get, like, an AM band for this.
That'd be nice.
It would be beautiful. Yeah. And then we could, you know, do this through an actual live or a streaming medium instead of this downloadable form.
Well, we do have, it is live. And if you click on when the show's happening, it is live. So it is live.
Okay, well, it...
But you have to have the internet to get it.
Right, but everybody has a radio. Well, virtually everybody has internet now.
Yeah.
But
it would be cool to have it on a show.
Yeah, yeah. On a radio, then we could also, like, replay this tape, do other things, have different shows. But through this way, you download it, and then you can hear it. It's not a streaming medium.
No, it is streaming.
Really?
It's streaming.
Okay, not through my browser, then.
No, it is. Oh, no, it's... Have you went to the website?
Yeah.
Oh, you have?
Yeah, I've tried to download this thing. It, like, was going to take me 3 hours.
Oh, yeah, if you're on a... Yeah, the problem is, yeah, if you're on a dial-up, it does take a while.
That's why I've actually never heard this show.
Oh, really? Yeah, it is a streaming show. I mean, it is streamed when it's done, and it's done, as we said, it's the second Friday of the month, and it's at 7 o'clock. So if you do click on it at that time, it does stream, and then we put the show posted as a download to it from there. Now, actually, okay, here's what you do. It is a stream, even right now when it's not being done. Now, what you do? Do you have Real Player?
Yes, I do.
Okay, and I think you can even do it with any MP3 player that'll stream it. If you just click on the link with Real Player, it should just play it.
Well, mine didn't.
It didn't do it?
No.
Okay.
It wouldn't. Make the little crossover between that.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. I know I can do it on my machine, and I can do it at work and a couple other machines. I'll talk with you about that.
But of course, I'm not the most technologically...
Could have an old browser or something.
Sophisticated person.
So when you click on it, what exactly happens?
It says download to, like, save to this file to here or to the disk or...
Like open
drive.
Or save.
Oh,
that.
For some reason, he doesn't have a... What is it? MIME extension? That validates that extension with the program.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
there's,
if you click on a JPEG,
no,
it opens
crossover
up with a PIC. Okay. You just have to reinstall Real Player, and that'll reinitialize those. There's a couple other things to do. I'll talk about it with you after the show.
All right.
So, moving on, we've got three final stories here. This one's a smaller story. It's about parents being able to track their kids at school. Plus, minus. I think there's some pluses. Yeah. Schools across the country are adopting computer programs that allow parents to check the internet daily to see whether kids skip class, hand in their homework, and even what they had for lunch. A cooperative representing 277 of Washington State's 296 school districts signed a contract this month to start bringing the technology into schools in fall of 2002. Despite the suspicions of the students who might feel their privacy is being violated, the law clearly states that parents have a right to look at their children's school records. And Andrew Shen of the Electronic Privacy Information Center in Washington, D.C., says, as long as the information posted is accurate and the system is secure, they shouldn't have a problem with privacy, he said. What it does is, and I don't even know, I think it has also something to do with, like, if your child gets on the web, it'll show a list of the websites he's went to. All your tallies, your roll, they do the roll, be input in a computer. They might even just do it in the classroom or show up. That's nice to see if a kid's skipping class or not, I think. They have the thing as well where it's, they have a thing at lunch. Like they said, if you go to the lunch counter and you say, I want to get some cake and I want a pizza, and it says no cake, they won't give you any cake. That's kind of a bummer. I wouldn't want that.
I think we're gonna raise a whole generation of really paranoid people.
Oh yeah.
Who are used to the idea of always being watched.
And there might be a revolution.
So the real, like, so the whole idea of Big Brother will already be, you know, accepted by them because that's the way it is.
And then, yeah, and that might be a weakness as a form of war. Let's just say if somebody tries to take over America, maybe we just let them.
Yeah, I don't like that idea. And plus, when are they considered to have rights from the constitutional rights? That's not really fair, do you think?
Well, they have the right to supervise their children just like a company has a right to supervise you because you're in their environment. Well, those are your kids.
Well, now, if they're doing it, like, through webcams, or is that's what they're talking about?
No.
Correct?
It's actually a web page. You visit a web page, okay. You put in a password, and then they'll give you a profile of your daughter, and put in the information from there. Show the information there.
Once everyone gets used to that.
But now, all the information of, like, you know, what your kids' grades are, you know, if they're skipping school and all that, that's already recorded. And if you're a conscientious parent, you already have access to that information.
By hand. This is more streamlined. The only thing that's a little digging deep, I think, is the lunch issue.
Yeah.
And I think that's digging deep. And you got to have your kids have a little place where they can pull off some stuff.
Well, because they're also going to be punished twice then.
Yeah.
For
at school and when they get in, two people. Well, it's got some pluses because if it streamlines what's already there, but I think the lunch thing's a little bit overboard. And checking where your child's websites go to, I think maybe only the websites that. Well, this goes back to deeming what's bad and what's good on the web on the websites on the internet. Maybe something like if the child went to an obvious porn website or something like that. If that was returned saying your child's going to school. I'm trying to reach to see if that's okay. I really don't think it's necessary.
But yet the schools already, you know, disallow any of those kinds of web pages.
Sometimes they disallow pages that are good. But, yeah. So, as long as they have a level head and they don't dig so deep, I think they're doing a little digging that they don't need to do. But I think if they streamlined, like, if they didn't show up for class and their grades and stuff like that. And it'd be even nifty if they talk about, like, stuff for, like, PTA meetings or, like, things are going on where the parents can be involved at school. I think that's good.
But in those kinds of things, why don't they just, like, email the parent those things?
It's just another medium. I guess email could be used.
Yeah.
Paper could be used. The child could bring the paper home. Well, this would be actually more for paperless, better for the environment, but...
I don't know. I was raised on, raised with practically no supervision, really. I mean, my parents would just say, "Hey, how'd you do in school or whatever? You get good grades or whatever?" Yeah, I guess so. I got an A or B. Okay. You know, they didn't. no one really cared to monitor me that much. And I would hate if I was a kid that was monitored as much as I've heard. This extra little feature would just, I'd go insane.
Yeah, because kids who come out of freshmen in college, they come from authoritative parents where they're really, really controlling.
Yeah.
Are the ones who screw up and drop out, or have the biggest chance of screwing up and dropping out, because they come and the first bit of freedom they get,
they're ready to take it on.
They go way too far.
Yeah,
it's like first
all those spring breakers.
Oh, spring break, that's like first semester out of college, or in college, is just, wow, I got $23,000 to go to college, so I can buy a lot of beer.
Have you seen those videos that they have on TV for spring breakers? I bet you these people don't even know they're on TV. I bet you some of these spring breakers have gone crazy by the video just to see if they're on it. I'm serious. If I was out there, I don't feel like exposing myself to everybody, but
like girls gone wild.
Yeah, yeah. And now they got a new one that Two Live Crew has. So they have some kind of like crazy videos they have, but that's just, I don't know.
Yeah, I heard about a guy that was going around Lake Tahoe, and throwing out beer to people if girls would flash him.
With the camera, huh?
Yeah, and then they would take a picture as they flashed.
Why don't they just buy the beer?
Yeah, just buy the beer, and they can flash themselves on the mirror.
Yeah, and then they said, how much money did those videotapes actually make? A lot.
Yeah, they do. Just like the Psychic Network. All right. Yeah. Well, here's another story about IP swapping for security. And this was a pretty interesting one. It might be interesting, may not be, as far as actual real use of it and how well it works. A new system can change the cyber addressing on a network faster than once a second, cloaking them from all the unauthorized parties, from all but authorized parties. We believe that our technology will serve an important role as a facilitator on Internet security and will start a new chapter in Internet history. Let's see. The person that invented it, his name is, let's see if I can get the first name here. Let's see. Well, we'll just go with the last name. Shaymov is a veteran of KGB's 8th Chief Directorate, the Soviet counterpart to the Pentagon. News websites, code cracking, eavesdropping, National Security Agency. By the time of his defection, what happened? He was actually a KGB expert and he defected over to the CIA. He was responsible for coordinating all KGB encrypted communications overseas. After defecting, he worked as a consultant and a contractor to NSA for several years, according to a company handout. This guy invented a process of security which basically has already been done with radio frequencies. What happens is when you're on the internet, you have an IP address, and what the system does is it hops around on IP addresses, which can confuse the person that's trying to grab some information. Let's say he grabbed it, and now he goes to go grab the rest of it, and it's gone. They do that with police. The police do that when they're on radio frequencies. They hop radio frequencies and they try to find it. I'm not sure how well this is going to work, because with the radio frequency, basically what they do is have something called a trunk tracker. And a trunk tracker will look at the trunk, which is basically a frequency range. Usually it's like 800 or 900 megahertz. And what it'll do is, if something drops, the minute it drops, it listens to see if something picks up at the very same time the other one drops. And then it'll go and jump around to wherever that comes up. And that works pretty well. They're pretty tough to get those things. So on the internet, there may be a means to implement something like that. So I'm not sure if that's going to work as well or very well. But it will be, with most security, it doesn't work completely, but it now creates another level of complicatedness or another level of education, or it would actually take somebody a little bit smarter, a little bit more crafty, a little bit more skilled to get past it. So
basically, when two computers want to communicate, then they have to have an algorithm to know where they're going to hop to,
and that's what I'm thinking, because they both have to know where the next one's going to go.
They have to have a handshaking, right? I don't get it.
Something like that. Maybe it'd be, if it was on an algorithm, just like credit cards are on an algorithm, how those numbers are produced, People have used that algorithm to come up with all, like, millions of credit cards because they know what number would be a right number and what number would be a bad number. The only thing they're missing is the expiration date. That's why they have the other factor. That would be bad. I don't know if it's something where it's you put in some values and it'll create a randomness. Not a random, but you put in the values on that machine and put the values on the other machine, and then they will create the randomness. It's not randomness, the sequential off of those values that'll be different. Well, they'll be the same, but it'll be different than all the other people that are using that type of technology. So
I know that FTP, when you connect to it through the 21 port, for example, it gives you a value that you have to determine and find the port, the random or arbitrary port number that sends the data back and forth.
FTP is 21, I think.
Yeah, that's the one where you start to initial contact, and it goes to sending data through some random port, another random port that you just...
Oh, yeah, it's a higher level because, yeah, each person will get their own port back if you have different users. Yeah.
Yeah.
Then they get, that's how they'll redirect it, so it's a constant.
Yeah, that helps for security, but I guess it's similar in that structure.
VR, do you know what we're saying?
I'm just trying to pick this up as we're going along. But okay. I'm there, but I have to actually, like, internalize it, interpret it. And then question it.
And produce something.
Yeah.
Well, okay. For someone who might not know what we're saying is, a computer can have an IP address. It's like a home address. Well, on a computer, there's actually different ports. Now, port is just many means of... It's communication, but it's organized communication. So, and they're just designated by numbers. I think it's 1 through 65,000. 1 through 65,000.
Oh, something like that.
Like that.
I think it depends on the system, though.
Like, there's common ports. Like, port 80 is your web port. So, if you send a message to a computer, it gets the message, but it says, where's this message supposed to go? It's supposed to go to port 80. Port 80 goes to my web server. My web server says, okay, I got this message. I'll return something back. What we're saying about the FTP side is when you get a message, you say, I think it's 21. I think 21 maybe Telnet. Which one's Telnet? 20?
Telnet is...
Can't believe I don't remember this right now.
I don't remember, 23 or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. Okay, so they'll get a message, and then what it'll do is it'll return it at a higher number. Let's just say it shoots the message back out at port 10,000, and then some other user, it shoots it back at port 10,001, so everyone has their own dedicated port. I believe that's how it works. Hopefully someone's not listening and saying, this guy has no idea what he's talking about. But I think that's how it works.
Okay.
Back to the point that the IP's jumping around, I think that could be pretty cool. I don't know if that's something they'd implement into the routers. I think it'd be something to put in the routers. I don't see why would everyone want to configure that at their desktops back to their server. But
yeah, that's another thing I don't understand is if it jumps IP addresses, then how I don't get why that works.
Okay, let's just say a header comes through, and this header says like TCP IP. Won't have to be messed with, in my opinion. I think this is how it would work. TCP IP, there has nothing that you'd have to add to the TCP IP protocol to make it work this way. Basically, it'd be like a normal transmission. Let's say the header packet comes through, describes that X amount of packets are coming through back here. Let's just say 20 packets go through, and then it jumps to another IP address. Well, now the receiver is going to jump the IP address at the exact instant. Now, it's just going to... It's going to be the brains and know what's going on. TCP IP is still going to be sending packets, and then it'll just keep collecting the packets as normal. And then maybe there'll be a management side where it keeps those packets being connected together, and then the transmission is finally received and then forwarded on to, from the software layer, forwarded on to, or from the hardware layer, I guess you could say, and then forwarded on to the software.
What if there was in a network? Okay, you have like a computer outside the network, a computer inside of a network, and this one's sending to another IP address a packet to another IP address, but this computer is supposed to receive it according to the security feature. What if there's another IP address on that system, another computer that had that IP address, took that and accepted that packet? Well, I don't get how that's supposed to work. There have to be some arbitrary number that doesn't make any sense.
Well, there would have to be that they both know what IP address to switch to.
Yeah.
To be sending to and receiving from at the same time.
And plus there could be one that already has that IP address.
Well,
no,
that'd be a part
of... Each individual IP address is assigned when you sign on.
Well, yeah, but in a network, I mean, you can create your own IP address. You have the whole 10 network, the 192 network, which is it's a range of numbers.
Right.
That is available for you only. Like, I have the 10 network.
Oh, yeah, because if another computer outside of the network was generating the new IP address, another within that network could already have that, would already be taking that IP address.
So how does it work?
Okay, well, what would you do? That's how you delegate IP address. I mean, that's like DHCP, and that could be a software. Like, let's just say this is put on the router would say, or whatever it's put on, or if it's its own separate entity, as far as a physical hardware box, if you put it on the computer, if you put it as software, router, whatever, I'd say that they would probably have a program amount in there. Say, like, from here to here, you can use those for swapping. And then on your network, you need to have IP addresses available for your computers. Well, on DHCP, you can create a scope.
Yeah, a pool.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's actually... No, that'd be... Well, okay. Maybe they... Wow, that'd be...
Or unless it's like the trunk thing of the radio frequency.
Yeah.
That it's...
You know, that...
Are you sure that you mean IP addresses?
No, you know what? I'm kind of... I think I understand. Yeah, because... That user's machine would have to swap, but I know in DHCP I can't say, well, this user's machine is allowed 10 IP addresses to swap around on the same subnet. But the only way I would see it is that each computer would have to be in its own subnet.
Yeah.
Which a subnet, VR, basically a subnet is the whole net itself, and it has a range. Subnetting is a thing like, if you put in your IP address, and they'll say, like, your subnet, it could be, like, 255.255.255.248, and it gives you, like, a small amount of computers to put on that network. Basically, it has to do with how the bits are changed and how...
Well, it's, like, the last, like, three numbers or whatnot, it would be a subnet.
Yeah. It's subnet value versus, like, hostname value. So, see, if, like, for subnet, let's just say I had the subnet of, like, 255.0.0.0.0, those... Zero zero zeros, because that's how it works. There's three decimals, and then four placements. Each one, let's see, those zeros, basically those bits are dropped, and those bits are now allowed for the hosts. So with the 255.0.0.0.0, you have a lot of hosts you can put on that network. And then if it's like a 255.255, or even like a 255.148.192.6, all those bits are like, some of those bits go to the network, some of those bits go to the hosts. So what would you do when you delegate, let's just say you have a network and you're given so many IP addresses, and you have like, and you're at a business and you have like an accounting department and you want to give the accounting department a whole different domain. Well, you can take the subnet bits and give more subnet and less IP addresses per subnet, so you can give each individual like five computers here, five computers there, five computers there, on subnets. So, through DHCP, which basically delegates when you get IP addresses back and forth to assign them to a computer to when they're on their network. Yeah, that there is a good question, because DHCP, if you were giving it to a computer, say this is your IP address, you don't qualify like this computer can use these range of IP addresses.
Yeah.
That's pretty weird. The only way I could see it work is if each computer had its own subdomain, and then it had 10 IP addresses it could juggle, 20, 30, or however you set it up from your host bits versus your subnet bits. That's pretty, yeah, that's kind of raises a good question. I don't know how they do that.
Maybe that's a typo or something, because I could understand ports, because ports are arbitrary, but you know, any computer has thousands of ports.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what it is, because that's what FTP does.
Yeah.
It would only be accepting and receiving information from a specific port.
Yeah.
Yeah, ports would be much easier in my mind. I don't know how they would do that with IP.
But you could override that by tapping into that and say you can receive this information from all ports. all your ports.
Yeah, see, that'd be a little easier because you know the IP address. You know the range of ports, so you can do where one drops and one listens.
Yeah.
Hmm.
See, otherwise it's not very secure anyway.
Yeah.
Because there's no way to switch, or there's no way to really be secure.
You'd have to have some false or some fake IP address that's understood within a subnet.
The only thing I'm thinking is that when you have a domain, because we're talking about inside a domain, computers communicating to the domain controller.
Hmm.
That's where we're having the problem with. I think it might be where you're outside the domain, and it's your WAN link. If you're talking to another domain or another trusted source, your ISP will give you, I mean, you could buy IP addresses. Let's just say you buy five. Five is a small number, you know, if you're going to find. But let's just talk simple. So if you buy five, maybe it's the routers or whatever hardware, whatever they use to delegate how this thing works. Maybe that's what they jump on. And I can see that working.
Yeah, that's possible.
So from outside your domain and then doing that, which would be, yeah, you know what? That's probably how it's done because it's going to be done over the Internet anyways. I'm sure for the Internet security. Otherwise, we'd be talking about different security. Yeah, they wouldn't use that for in-house.
So one computer could have five or more IP addresses, and it would switch between those.
Domain. I think it's domain. Like domain to another trusted source, which would be like another domain.
Well, like my computer could have like five or more, as far as I know, IP addresses directed to it. You know, if I were a server.
Yeah, which would you'd be a domain.
Okay.
So.
Which I would be kind of like receiving from all your ports.
Yeah.
Of like you can receive you'll be picking up information from any of these, you know, IP addresses or domains.
So you could switch from IP addresses, but also create more randomness by saying port. So it would be harder for a person to look on all ports and all IP addresses for that domain. So I guess that would.
Well, this next bit of news would actually go along with this, because talking about all these ports, well, that means more ports and just not that. I mean, more IP addresses, and there's not that many to give out right now. So this is IPv6, which has been around since. I think the software has been out since 1998, and addresses have been available since 1999. Read this quickly. Let's see. IPv6 addresses, actually to explain what IPv6 is, instead of the four, actually it's the three, like the three, zero, the three decimals dot, three decimals dot, three decimals dot, three decimals platform for how they usually do the IP addressing. Basically it's four. 4, 4, and 4, and it's actually, it can be hexadecimal, so it's letters and digits.
So how many possible IP addresses can you get from that type of subnet pattern, whatever?
Not sure. I'd have to do the math.
Is it like in the billions?
It's above the billions.
Trillions?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's 4 billion. It's 4 billion for IPv4. So this is much, much larger. It's in the trillions, actually.
Yeah, it'd actually be that times 26 factorial.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a lot.
Oh,
IPv6 addresses have been available since 1999 and are expected to be the driving force behind IPv6 upgrades. Millions of the next generation wireless phones will each have an IP address. That's one of the main benefactors of this. Is there's a lot of things that be using this, like the security. Need an IP address to work properly, and the numerous devices connected to the Internet, such as office IP phones or gaming devices, will also need individual addresses. Some estimate that the 4 billion addresses available in the current IPv4 will be depleted by 2010. Without IPv6 deployed in the Internet's core, there's little incentive to develop applications that would require the new standard. But with no paying customers in sight, why bother to upgrade networks? Japan is the first to deploy IPv6 because they were the last on the previous Internet. They didn't make any money out of it. And since this is actually, you know, selling addresses to people, they see that the IPv6 has an infrastructure that would help them regain lost ground on the Internet. Japan will release the new addresses the soonest. Currently, North America has 74% of the IP address Europe has 17, and Asia has 9. Other U.S. players, large and small, are entering the fray. Last week, Cisco Systems announced that it will add IPv6 software to the next generation of its router's management software. Microsoft is making the IPv6 software available to download for the Windows XP Software Developers Kit upgrade, and IPv6 is available with the certain flavors of Linux and Unix. New vendors such as California startup Internet Share has developed products aimed for enterprises. So IPv6 is going to be a pretty good thing for the internet. It's well needed, and I think it's going to be pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, well, that's it for In the Now. We actually did a little bit longer show for this one. A couple things to announce is the Arizona State Linux Users Group is going to have a meeting June 14th, and they're going to be talking about routers. And the Macintosh Users Group is going to be having a presentation on Macintosh OS 10 June 21st. Go to the website slipnet.org, click on meetings to get more information on locations of the meetings. All right.